I've got a solo episode today, and there's a few things going on in the world of Jake and the wider kind of macro environment that I thought would be really interesting to talk through. So, like I've done in the past, three subjects, and I'm just going to break them down how I see things today. So, the first is ETFs, and particular BlackRock. The ETF market is a very, very, very interesting development when it comes to Bitcoin. And there's lots of nuance to what it actually means, in my opinion. But the really short story is nothing beats Bitcoin in self-custody. So if anyone out there is considering buying Bitcoin via an ETF, ask yourself the question, why am I not doing this myself? And if you don't, you miss what is essentially one of the superpowers of Bitcoin, which is the ability to self-custody. So you can take this digital asset, you can put it in a place that only you can control, and it can't be taken from you, and it cannot be debased on the back end. So it's a reduction of counterparty risk for the store of wealth that has never been accessible to humans ever before. It's an extraordinary innovation. And by not asking that simple question, can I do this myself, or why am I not doing this myself, then you're missing one of the superpowers of Bitcoin. Let's move aside from that and have a look at what you can actually do otherwise and why people are doing this. So I got sent something this week that was BlackRock in full Pac-Man mode. So if you think about Pac-Man, that old school computer game, there's that thing coming along, just eating everything, right? The BlackRock Bitcoin ETF called IBIT had inflows, which is basically capital coming into this ETF, of $800 million in a day. And the tweet had maybe 20 different dates, and it was, because it all has to be transparent, right? So exactly how many dollars are coming in and how many Bitcoin are being matched against that. And BlackRock take a fee for essentially what's like a securitization process on top of Bitcoin. And due to the regulatory environment for a lot of investors and the funds that they run, whether they be high net wealth, whether they be insurance or pension funds, hedge funds even, they've taken money from people and they've been given a remit to invest it in a certain way and in certain things. And so a lot of these people, and this is why you hear the phrase, like, the retail market has been able to front run Wall Street. What that means is that there's a whole community of funds under management out there, professionally managed in regulated environments, that actually stops them from buying Bitcoin in self-custody. And it's hilarious in some ways. Like, I personally, Jake, I have front run Wall Street. And it's not just Wall Street, right? It's the City of London, it's Frankfurt, it's Sydney, it's Tokyo, it's all these massive financial hubs that literally have regulated themselves out of owning Bitcoin in self-custody. So when you see the inflow stats, it's like, wow, this is dollars coming from somewhere, other assets, presumably. And coming into Bitcoin, this is additional demand. Now, what I'm very dubious of is the counterparty risk. So if you own an ETF, you pay dollars for it, and you've got Bitcoin exposure. Great. So for a lot of these fund managers or financial advisors that weren't previously able to get access to Bitcoin for their customers, they can now do it. And we're now May of 2025. A lot of these products first came out very beginning of last year. And in some ways, like, the Bitcoin price last year reflected that, right? All this additional demand that flew into Bitcoin. And we saw all-time highs last year much quicker than we expected. You're like, whoa, that was fast. But what's happening now is it's just more money coming, right? More money coming. And as of right now, we're sitting at circa $110,000 a Bitcoin. We entered price discovery again for the first time in a few months. i.e. the price broke out above the previous all-time high for a period of time. And I mean, this is magic to me. This is, as a Bitcoin advocate, as a Bitcoin holder, as someone who's adopted it as a savings technology, it's like, this is what we've been waiting for. It's like, come on, let that price run. Now, of course, we can speculate, like, where's it going to go, on what timeline. Anyone that predicts price and time is basically going to get it wrong. Always try to remember this idea that, you know, all models are wrong. Some are helpful, most are dangerous. And so I like thinking about this kind of stuff on a much more macro level. It's like, okay, digital scarcity has been created for the first time, and that is Bitcoin. And Bitcoin is a representation of that that we've never been able to use before. And I've discussed in the past something called a Veblen good. So if you think about a Gucci handbag, and there's only five of them in the world, and actually there are people out there that if it only costs 20 grand, they'll be like, whatever. But if it's 200 grand, then they'll buy it. I.e., the demand and price, the price goes up instead of down. And you're like, whoa. So as the price gets more expensive, the demand increases, which is the inverse of what a normal supply demand curve would do. And Bitcoin's the same, right? So at $110,000, the same demand, you're seeing these inflows into BlackRock coming through. And it's like, well, there's no more Bitcoin, right? The supply is capped. They cannot increase that. And so for the first time ever, you're getting this scarce asset matching inbound demand. And of course, the price action is to the upside. It's very simple. There's no more supply, and therefore price goes up. But what I think will start to happen, and you see that the big, big asset managers talk about this kind of stuff. It's like, yeah, Bitcoin's a $2 trillion asset, but you know the bond market is hundreds of trillion. So they can actually shift in size through the bond market. You just can't physically do it in Bitcoin because it's too small. So there's all this money sitting out there that's going, okay, I currently own a bond. It's got a fixed yield for a 10-year period. The real rate of money inflation means that I'm actually getting back less purchasing power. And it's a shit investment, essentially. It's like, why would you give someone your money, get paid for it over a period of time in which they can print more of the bits of money you're getting paid in? Like, doesn't make sense. And even, I won't bang on about this, but like the idea of a negative interest rate is completely insane. Anyway, these ETFs, they're an interesting representation of demand for Bitcoin that isn't actually able to access Bitcoin itself. And that to me is fascinating. Okay, cool. So there's all this money out there that would like to own Bitcoin but previously couldn't. And maybe they've got a bit of a taste for it and they're coming back. And they're coming back. But what are my fears? Well, my fears are, as I touched on before, the counterparty risk. Like, what happens when those dollars that were paid for all the Bitcoin, there might be some kind of government overreach, right? And this happened before in the 1930s in the US. Like, gold was confiscated by the government and you had to hand your gold in. Anyone out there that tells you, oh, they'll never impound all the Bitcoin that BlackRock have, like, it's happened before and it will happen again at some point. So would that be a nice situation to be in? Imagine you've gone and put a load of money into Bitcoin, but you did it via an ETF, via your financial advisor, and suddenly you've made all these amazing gains in dollar terms, but it's like, oh, well, I want my Bitcoin now. They're like, sorry, guys, we've actually got a government mandate here, and we're going to pay you out in dollars for all the Bitcoin that you own, so you'll get the dollar return, but we're actually going to keep that Bitcoin, and they just printed more dollars than you can physically ever imagine. So they get it for free. For a period of time, they're going to scoop up the scarcest asset that's ever existed, and then you're left with dollars that buy less shit in 2 days' time, 4 days' time, 6 days' time, 6 months' time. So I'll come back to where I was at the start, which is, if you're thinking about getting exposure to Bitcoin through an ETF, ask yourself, why can't I do this myself? And if you don't have a good answer for that, then you really need to think about how to study and self-custody Bitcoin better. I've done it myself. Yes, there are hours of research. Yes, there are times you're like, ooh, I hope I haven't got that wrong. But I now have an extraordinary sense of peace and calm when it comes to the safety of my wealth, because I'm like, cool, it's in Bitcoin self-custody. It's almost impossible to get. And that for me is an incredibly powerful thing. So how do I kind of wrap this one up? It's like, I love seeing news articles of ETFs pumping demand for Bitcoin. But I would love to temper that with, what are you actually buying? And there's basically, there's a derivative of Bitcoin that's been developed here, which is claims is a one-to-one backing, right? All of these regulators are insisting on the providers of these products that they do it. You know, there's no rehypothecation, there's no leverage in there. It's literally like you put 100 grand or 10 grand or $1 into an ETF, and they have to buy the Bitcoin on the back end, or at least that's what they're supposed to. Now, is that always going to be true? I don't know. Is that something that you should look into? Absolutely. But yeah, so BlackRock, the Pac-Man. I think a final point here that's important to mention is the headline will be BlackRock accumulates Bitcoin. And in some ways, that's true. But it's not BlackRock with their own balance sheet saying, we want to buy lots of Bitcoin. It's BlackRock with a financial product that is helping other people access Bitcoin. So when you, I mentioned that that real headline grabbing number, you know, over $800 million of IBIT was secured in a single day. It's like, whoa, but that's not BlackRock's money. That's actually other people making the decision to use BlackRock's product. And so it's like, I actually think it's a much more interesting reflection rather than the largest asset manager in the world deciding to buy a bit of Bitcoin, which is inevitably going to be the case. At this stage, I don't know if they own Bitcoin on their balance sheet. They're obviously making money from having a Bitcoin product, and the IBIT is the most successful, or the Bitcoin ETFs. I don't want to misquote this. I certainly read that the Bitcoin ETFs are the most successful financial products ever created. Isn't that insane? And that's alongside the fact you could just own it in self-custody. So you could argue, I think, that Bitcoin is the most important innovation in investment, finance, and money ever. So yeah, let that one percolate. And yeah, anyway, the point I'm trying to make here is that as you see inflows into the BlackRock ETF, it's really a representation of demand from the wider investment market. So, okay, what's really going on here? And that's where it's important to zoom out. Okay, let's say Bitcoin is a roughly $2 trillion market today. Total global assets are roughly $900 trillion. So, wow. Well, Bitcoin's not even 1% of the market. That's absolutely wild, right? If we get to $9 trillion of Bitcoin value, then suddenly you're at 1% of global assets. So, okay, well, if Bitcoin is faster, stronger, cheaper, i.e. like from a technological play, it will outcompete the status quo. And you try and compare, you say, okay, look, gold is roughly a $20, $25 trillion market right now. Gold is you know, very good at holding value across time. And putting aside all the gold suppression pricing that happens due to the ability of central banks to use like very gray partners in different parts of the world to basically short sell gold. Larry Lepard's a really interesting person to listen to talk about that, the gold market experts all over this. But what Bitcoin is much better than gold at is sending value across space. So imagine you're sending gold from Tokyo to New York, or you're sending gold from Sydney to London. It's like, it's going to take time. There's a lot of cost involved because you've got to protect it on the way there. It's very hard to split up. It fails essentially at sending value across space. Whereas Bitcoin, you can send a decimal place of it at a fraction of a second anywhere in the world, as long as someone's plugged into the Bitcoin network. You're like, whoa, I mean, this is a game changer. And so global assets, 900, roughly. Well, 1% of that, 9. Bitcoin, 2. Do you bet that Bitcoin is going to be better at doing what gold does than gold? Yes. Okay, so you've got a $20 trillion market cap to go after. You're already at 2, so you're taking 10% of that market. Could it get to 50? Yeah, I think it might well easily get to 50 because gold doesn't even send value across space. Okay, well, that's already massive upside from here. And then you look at the global market for assets, like, oh my God, Bitcoin is so tiny compared to everything else that currently exists. And I personally believe it's much better at store of value than housing. So the real estate market's going to get absolutely trashed. The bond market's going to get absolutely trashed. And those two, for me, are the first ones who're like, come on, like people are dropping investment properties to buy Bitcoin. People are dropping bonds to buy Bitcoin. And those are hundreds and hundreds of trillions of dollars of value. Long story short, hyper bullish. And using this kind of macro lens helps to do that. But it's like, okay, what the ETFs really represent is people who have regulated themselves out of owning Bitcoin in self-custody, or perhaps don't want to take the risk of holding the keys themselves. There are additional reasons why you wouldn't do it, don't get me wrong. And that's what I find exciting about the ETFs. I just hope, touch wood, that they don't get rug pulled in some savage way, what happened with gold in the 30s in the US. Because, you know, you might make 4x, 3x your money, who knows? And you want to get it out. So, oh, well, actually, we'll give you dollars back. You know, I don't want dollars. I want the Bitcoin. And then it might just break in a kind of spectacular way. Anyway, I'll leave that there. And yeah, just self-custody your Bitcoin. Simple. Okay, topic number two, Noster. I recently had Daniel, aka BTC Gandalf on the podcast, and it's really got me thinking about what do I personally want to do. And to, if you haven't listened to the episode, it is literally the episode before this recording, so go back and have a listen if you've got time. And like, great guy, great story, amazing progress. And it's like, what do you do if you've figured out a bunch of skills to monetize them for yourself? And his product, You Are the Monopoly, is a really nice take on how effective a personal brand can be at basically supercharging whatever business it is you're involved in. Digital leverage is another good way of thinking about it. And I posed the question to him about, okay, well, what about platform risk? And he's got, you know, whatever it is, 100,000 Twitter followers or something. It's taken many years and countless hours to build the audience, but it could be switched off tomorrow. And his reaction was very interesting. And he's like, well, number one, I could just do it all over again. And what I love about that is unbelievably good recognition of the value of intellectual capital. Like, when you learn something, it's the knowledge itself that then drives the financial returns. So we should always be investing in ourselves in that sense, acquiring new skills, figuring out stuff, getting it wrong, trying again, getting back up. Fuck, it didn't work. Try again. And he was very bullish on email. And so, and I've seen this strategy from quite a few digital marketers where they're basically using Twitter to top of funnel, catch attention, get people into their ecosystem with a tweet or with a short form clip of some kind of meme. And before you know it, you're in their kind of ecosystem and you can end up on Shopify or you can end up on Gumroad or something and buy a course. Or in Daniel's case, he has a program for developing people's personal brands, and it's a consulting service. And it's something I might well personally do. Year one for me is all about the content with the podcast, but ultimately it's a media business. And I would like to figure out, well, what are the strategies that I actually would like to fit into my life and also create some value for people. Anyway, this idea that, oh, don't worry, I can use my Twitter and I can just build it all over again. It's like, oh, that'd be a fucking shitload of time you've just lost in some ways. Yes, you've got the knowledge, but like, you know, what a lot of effort for someone else. There's basically a big risk there, in my opinion. Yes, you can get people's emails, and yes, they are an excellent way of communicating, and it's something that I'm also interested in looking at myself. But it's like, hello, we've got this Noster thing, right? And in particular, Daniel was like, just really focus on one thing. And it's making me think, well, if I was asked that question, if he was coaching me, what would my one thing be? And I know it's Noster, for sure. And you're like, okay, why? Or what's stopping you? The thing that stops me is like, it is actually, frankly, someone like Daniel. He's like 90,000, 100,000 Twitter followers. He's now got a digital audience that he's helping to leverage and create a digital business with that he can go anywhere in the world. This all sounds awesome. You're like, great. And, you know, there's hundreds of millions of active users on X. And it's just obviously a strategy that works. And you're like, Noster, tiny. I mean, last time I looked, 25 to 30 or maybe 50,000 daily active users. And the delayed gratification that you'd be required to embrace when really going, like, if it's like all in on one, okay, all in on Noster, it's like, well, there's no one really using it right now. And therefore you're walking away from like big audience size and perhaps even walking away from the marketplace for ideas. Like, is that the right call, is to like head to this niche or smaller part of the internet, this thing we call Noster, and hang out there and not force, but like focus your attention there? And I actually just posted a note about this. It's like, what do I think that I could do if Noster is the one and you wanted to really focus on that? Well, you could release podcast episodes a day early. I've seen Knut and Luke doing that quite effectively on their podcast. You could have Noster exclusive content, and you could start to really think about some of the different business models. Like, I really love this idea of Sats Flow, as that's like the primary goal of a business operated today, is to build a business that is earning in Bitcoin. And if you can do that at a profitable rate, then you are just scooping up Bitcoin from the marketplace that you can then keep in your treasury reserve and use to build your business or pay out dividends or just literally hold Bitcoin. And it's like, well, hello, Nostr's like Zaps, right? Imagine if you could create a very successful account in Nostr that's actually getting paid in Bitcoin, like, all day long for that content. And this is, of course, the dream and the vision of Nostr. But I think, like, when I come back into myself and really think about what do I personally need or want, it's like, well, I know that I love talking to people. I know that I love telling stories. I know that I love listening to good stories. I love people's decision making. I love conversation as an art, in a sense. And I for some reason, in particular, it's the ultra long form men speaking. It's like, you can't hide, right? And let's talk about the hardest possible things. What is the most controversial? Why is it the most controversial? Tell me something I didn't previously know. Question status quo. Figure out what is a better way of doing things. And if the podcast is the center of everything, I don't think that it's a rational decision at this point not to post on RSS feeds and therefore to iTunes and Spotify and to Fountain, for example. And equally to not post on YouTube and X and Rumble when you're already creating the content seems foolish. And I'm fortunate to be in a position where I've got Michael, my producer, shout out, and Pat, my editor, shout out. Great guys. We're building an awesome little team. It's not hard to post across multiple platforms at the same time, the same content. It just takes time. So there's some work involved, but it can be done. But I think what Daniel's conversation has really jolted in me is the idea that you've got to go be social on these platforms, right? You can't just post stuff on Instagram and get big. You can't just post stuff on X and get big. You've actually got to spend time on there, commenting and liking and hanging out and doing this and doing that. It's like, well, I don't want to do that on a platform that's going to rug pull me. You know, if I'm going to have conversations that the powers that be, if we're kind, don't want to hear, then it's just a matter of time that you get rug pulled. Either you get shadow banned in some way, or your account's just straight up like, you failed to meet the community guidelines, you're gone. And so when I think about this from a capital allocation perspective, I like to think this through, as you guys will know if you've listened to this podcast, humanistic, intellectual, and financial capital is the wider buckets. As a podcast, a fledgling podcast, like, what's the best thing long term? So, okay, well, what if you could delay gratification for 5 years? I mean, that's what Daniel said. He spent 5 years building his Twitter audience. I mean, it's not a short amount of time. And I'm sure he was a character I came across, you know, way back in 2020, and we're just banging about Bitcoin all day long on Twitter. Awesome. And good for him to have built this. Like, really, congratulations and awesome progress. But for me sitting here now, it's like, okay, well, Nostr is this new thing that might not have the eyeballs that the traditional media businesses or the status quo digital monopolies currently have. But what does it have? Well, it has the building blocks and the ingredients for something radically better than the status quo. And so in particular, it's obviously this idea that you can't be censored. You know, because the information that is floating around the Nostr protocol is spread in such a way that, you know, you can just use a different client. And therefore, it's very, very hard to suppress an account. And that in itself is enough, I think. It's like, you can't be switched off. It's like, brilliant. What would be the point in going somewhere where you can? And it's like, how much self-censorship is going on for someone like Daniel? Like, I'd love to ask him this question. Is that Twitter audience so valuable that they're not talking about things that they would like to talk about? And maybe it's even subconscious. They might be like, oh, I can't mention that because, you know, I might lose my account. Because Nostr, you don't have that. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why you spend time on Nostr, the experience is different. Not only you don't have the kind of clickbaity, algorithm-driven, like, hate bullshit that flies around where it's just like, oh my God, am I talking to a robot? Or like, why am I so angry? And I don't get the same, like dopamine low after, you know, you haven't been played with by the software product. That in itself is a great, great experience that's definitely better. I think it's this whole idea of like power back to the people. You know, it's like the user is the center of Nostr. And so if you're the product, if the product is free, you're the product. And so that's why it's been an interesting experience posting content on Nostr. It's like, okay, well, actually, you have to have a Nostr.b build account. And, you know, shout out to Fishcake for doing that. And hopefully we can get some analytics and stuff going. And I've given him feedback as to, I don't even know actually at this point, as to how they might improve their product. It's a collaboration because I need it, right? I want to know, like, where's my content going? Who's seeing it? But equally, the data set that they give back isn't the same because they don't know necessarily the location of a Nostr account. They don't necessarily know the age. There's a lot. It's different, but you can still see how much attention did your content get. And that is ultimately what I might sell if I was to do an advertising contract. I'm not sure I'm going to go in that direction because I think I like the idea of developing my own products that are specific to the audience rather than attaching myself to brands that, I mean, ultimately, a brand can go and do what the hell they want. You'd want to work with partners that you trust in them as business leaders. And maybe those people are out there. I haven't even really explored that yet as a monetization process. I wanted to just really focus on a year of creating content. But yeah, so long story short, it's like, okay, well, if I had to go all in on any of these things, it's so obvious to me you go all in on Nostr. Let's do it. Because actually, I have built a position of strength where, well, financially, I don't have to get a return today. I don't have to go out and sell a course for $1,000. I don't have to go out and do one-on-one coaching for 10 grand. I am an investor and I've made some excellent investments. And those financial capital positions have given me the time to then go and do what I'm now actually iterating for the first time and explaining almost to myself is invest in my intellectual capital for Nostr. Go and figure this thing out, learn about it. And actually a person who came to mind, Alex Svetsky, shout out to him. He's going to be coming on the podcast very soon, is building a business, Satlantis, on Nostr. And it's just such a, I really thought to myself, that's the kind of ballsy shit that entrepreneurs do. It's like you adopt a fledgling protocol that everyone's like, what is it? It's pointless. I much prefer to keep my Twitter account and do something different and improve the status quo. And suddenly we'll all be using Satlantis and we don't even realize how or why. It's just better. And that, I think, is what's so exciting. It's like the maybe it's some anxiety, some self-doubt. You question yourself. It's like, is this really like the thing I should be doing with my time? And it's obvious to me, like, yeah, crack on, mate. Absolutely go for it. But you still have those moments of, am I completely mad? Maybe I can link it in the show notes. Corn DeLorean, I hope to get you on the podcast at some point. But great meme that they posted recently with, I can't even explain what it was, but if you've ever played Jenga, like with your kids, you know, you have three blocks and three blocks and three blocks and three blocks. And it was an image of like a circle of Jenga blocks with just one Jenga block at the bottom. And it was like, this is the platform risk of social media. And he had an arrow at the bottom to like X and Instagram. So all these people that think they've built themselves a valuable empire have actually built it on this one Jenga block that at any point could be whipped from underneath them. And just, it's a great meme because it's exactly what I've been thinking about. And it's like, well, obviously you want to be focusing your time, which is the only thing more scarce than Bitcoin, on something where your time can't be stolen. And that is Nostr. Boom. Final one today is completely different. So have you ever heard of the term feng shui? I must admit, I hadn't really looked at anything like this very closely until recently. It's a term that I heard about, 20 years ago as a kid growing up. But I have been looking very closely at the potential to buy some land and build a family home. And this would be a real estate investment. It is an area in which I am not an expert. If anything, I have made real estate investments in the past and they went poorly. So I'm not a very good real estate investor. And that makes me quite hesitant, if I'm honest. But my aim is I really want a family home. And so I'm trying to figure out different ways of skinning the cat. It's like, how do you do this the most effective way? How do you not sell your Bitcoin, essentially? It's like you want to keep as much equity in Bitcoin as you possibly can. But then equally, like, when are you getting greedy? If it's gone up by multiples, like, it makes some sense, in my opinion, to, you know, actually buy the things that you need in life. That's what Bitcoin is at the end of the day. Anyway, I've been searching for bits of land, and this one came up, and just unbelievable view, like unbelievable, plus a short drive time to the local town where I live. So it ticked my wife's box of like not being too far out of town, and it ticked my box of like I'd love to have an epic view. And my friend sent it to me, and I immediately was like, oh, this is the one. This is the one. I know it's the one. And I hooked up a viewing, went there with the agents, took the whole family there. And I mean, the view did not let down. It was unbelievable. But what was interesting was what happened after that. So shout out to Jason Parks, my mentor, who took a look at the property listing with me and was like, Jake, can I offer you another perspective on this? And I was like, absolutely, yes, please. And I'd been saying like how I was quite surprised at how steep the cliff was in front of the house. And I was talking about how the road was pretty noisy out the back. And there wasn't therefore all that much land to potentially build on the top of this hill. And it was right at the top of my price range. And putting aside half of what Jason and I talked about, because that's not necessary for this point, but the art or the study of feng shui is basically an Eastern philosophy that I believe started in China, but Jason has spent time with the Shaolin monks and was a civil monk himself for many years and is an expert in energetics. And it just was such a revealing conversation to have. But first of all, when someone builds on a piece of land, the energy and nature are messed with in some way. So even if you come along and you find a really old house and you're like, I'm going to bring fresh vibe and I'm just going to knock this whole place down and we're going to revamp it and give it a new lease of life, it's still the imprint of the previous work that was done remains with the land. And so he spent a lot of time talking me through the dwelling that was currently there. And it's an old house built in the 80s. And to my wife and I, we're just like, let's knock it down and start again. But he's talking about the colors of this house. It's like a brown brick, brown on brown on brown, represents stagnancy. And he's like, well, and look at all the jungle in front. Like nothing's been done there for years and years and years. This property is very stagnant. Like who has owned this and let it get to this state? And basically shaking that energy of stagnancy would be very, very hard. And you might put a lot of time and energy and effort into it, but it would slowly but surely seep back. And he spoke through the energy of the road, which was right behind the property, basically the driveway, short driveway into the back of the house. And that is essentially like a river of water, right? And that water is coming in off the road into the back of the property. And then the front of the property is all glass, so there's nothing holding it to support it. Basically, this water is just shooting straight out the front of the house and down the cliff. And it would be like living at the top of a waterfall from an energetic perspective. And he said it'd be very, very hard to hold together relationships. And he then started looking through the foundations of the house and the other pictures, and he found all of these open beams that were chopping rooms up, including one over the primary bedroom, right down the middle of the main bed. And in his view, that would be a sign of the relationship being cut for whoever or whomever might be in that house. And you're like, well, I mean, married, three kids, very happily so. Like, I don't want to be building a house where I'm on top of a energetic waterfall that might chop my relationship up. But there are things that, to me, as someone who's not studied feng shui and is not yet as sophisticated in energetics as they would like to be, this stuff was just not even close to being obvious to me. I didn't even think about it, right? I just turned up like, banging view. This would be epic. How do I get it? And I did have some concerns about the road and some concerns about the cliff, but this all just was much, much richer context for what you might be able to do there. And it's like, okay, well, obviously, I don't want to be building a place that is supportive and safe for a young family to grow and learn and try and fail and try again. The final piece that he mentioned that really was a bit of a shock, to be honest, was like it's on a triangular block. And he said triangular blocks are the worst like literally the very worst to build property on. And I couldn't say exactly why, but he's like, this is the kind of block that like people will get cancer and die. The triangular block is the worst thing you can possibly build on because of the outcomes that are created when you have that. And you're like, oh, wow. I mean, obviously we don't want that either. So, you know, when you're trawling through real estate options, you're looking at this and looking at that, and there's all these other different metrics that I'm interested in, and also features, right? I don't want to have a moldy house. I don't want to have any cell towers nearby. I don't want any big pylons or anything. And I want to build a specific low-tox, healthy home with techniques like passive house and hempcrete as the material. And that's all great, but like, what about the energetics overlay that I've just talked through? So yeah, the reason to share this is just a really interesting experience I had this week in a field that I had no idea about and helped me make a decision. And the decision was, this is not the right place. Now, from a feng shui perspective, what should I be looking for? Well, first of all, a square block, much, much stronger position to build from. And what Jason taught me through and taught me was that you want to have the road not running at the back of the house, but at the front of the house. And it's like wealth should flow towards you and then carry on. And it's just this overall idea of like, you want the property to be supportive from an energetics perspective. And if it isn't, there will be externalities that you won't want. And so if, like me, you're trying to you know, build a life that is optimized for, you know, vitality, longevity, parenthood, freedom, and health, you're like, well, you need to think about these things, basically. So that was a big lesson for me this week. And from now onwards, I will, when it comes to real estate specifically, I will be much more interested in that, almost as like a first port of call. So, okay, I've got five options here. Let's take a look at all of them. Which ones feel right? Which ones feel wrong? And so, yeah, absolutely. I would advocate for this. Find a Jason. Find someone that can help you from this perspective. And at the end of the day, you're the decision maker, right? It's your fault if it goes wrong, and it's your win if it goes well. But if you haven't overturned every option on the way to finding out if it's a good idea, that's on you. And this was just a brilliant example of like, you can still ask more questions. You can still look deeper. You can still get advice from more people. And I wish I'd done it sooner, because there's so many properties that I've looked at in the last 6 to 8 months where they just, none of them would have been right. His final comment was like, the right place will turn up at the right time. And you're like, oh, it's so annoying, right? You're like, I really don't want that to be true. I want it to be like fixed now, because I really want a family home. But equally, this is perhaps that process of like living in the pain slightly. It's like, okay, well, we have built ourselves this great place of buoyancy due to, you know, a predominantly digital wealth strategy, right? Go anywhere we want, really. But also there's this yearning for land, for a home. And yes, your house doesn't have to be your home. But right now, that's just, if there was one thing I wasn't going to buy that wasn't Bitcoin, it would be a house of some form. Anyway, a work in progress and an insight that's hopefully enjoyable. Feng Shui is something I'm going to learn a lot more about. That ends today's podcast. Obviously, and as always, any questions, reach out. Love to hear from you. Thank you so much.